Is this cool? 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 Is that cool? All these people, are they cool? Is this cool? This guy. Cool, is he? This guy. Is he cool?
No!
This woman. Is she cool? So what about me? Do I look cool? Well, do I? Do I look cool? Do I really look cool? Do I?
Junior Aspirin Records, audio annotations for the Serling Library. Session number 2, notes on taste and authenticity. Taste, as an aesthetic, sociological, economic, and anthropological concept, refers to cultural patterns of choice and preference. Taste is about drawing distinctions between things such as styles, manners, consumer goods, and works of art. Social inquiry of taste is about the human ability to judge what is beautiful, good, and proper. Cultural consumption is a communicative act. It is an act of interpretation based on knowledge of a code.
You got good taste, you got good taste, you compare.
The sociologist Pierre Bourdieu claims that how one chooses to present one's social space to the world, one's aesthetic dispositions, depicts one's status and distances oneself from lower groups. Specifically, Bourdieu hypothesizes that these dispositions are internalized at an early age and guide the young towards their appropriate social positions, towards the behaviors that are suitable for them, and an aversion toward other behaviors.
I must have been bit by a spider when I was very small. Because now I'm grown up, I spend 5 days a week going up the fucking wall. I must have been fenced into a long straight road when I was 9 or 10. Because now I'm grown up, I spend 5 days a week going round the fucking bend.
Quentin Crisp said,
"Fashion is what you adopt when you don't know who you are."
Justice. death.
Something in the city air, a tang permeating today's mutating sensibilities of consumption. It's in museum gift shops and the evolution of the word creative from adjective to job title. In the rate at which designer fashion collections are copied by Main Street clothing stores and the way expensive apartments are marketed as promising an urban, edgy living experience. In the soggy legacy of appropriation art, and those guilty moments of relativist ennui that make one suspect that The Sopranos is more interesting than most video art. It's in YouTube clips, efflux announcements, iPad apps, internet shopping, and the frequency with which James Franco appears in artworks and in cultural gossip columns. In the way that celebrities are referred to in the media by their first names rather than their surnames, and the way Warhol is always called Andy and Duchamp never Marcel. It's in the synergistic smell of capital, convenience, and the promise of better living through cultural acquisition.
I don't like country and western. I don't like rock music. I don't like rockabilly. Rockabilly particularly. I don't like much really, do I? But what I do like, I love passionately.
John Savage, from the sleeve notes to Saint Etienne's album Foxbase Alpha. June 4th, 1989. It's a Sunday morning. The weather's not bad enough to be a downer, and in the hard black economy, cash in your pocket puts a spring in your step. On the way into town, you can see London spread out before you. The tombstone skyscrapers of the city and Docklands. The winking lights of the post office tower and Crystal Palace. In the distance, the hills. Down in Camden, London is in your throat. The lowest point in the city, a sink for pollution, noise and destitution. But it's here that you find the raw material to make the world in the way that you hear it. Walking through congested streets and alleys, you're assaulted by a myriad of sounds, looks and smells from all over the world, each with its own memory and possibility. How to make sense of this? Go with the flow, find out what has been forgotten, put it together in a new way. Today's halls are Mashed Down by Roots and Bamba in Dub by The Revolutionaries. A battered single telling you how to convert LSD into decimal currency. A couple of Northern Soul compilations on Kemp. Overpriced UK psych singles on labels like Camp and Page One. The look is easy. Wigs, turtlenecks and corduroys. The rhythms of the moment are playing non-stop in Zoom. The idea is mental freedom, transformation in the familiar. Primrose Hill, Staten Island, Gospel Oak, Sao Paulo, Boston Manor, Costa Rica, Arnos Grove, San Clemente, Maida Vale, Studamer. Stay busy, out of phase, in love.
Maida Vale, Old Ford, Valencia, Kennington, Galveston,
Filmmaker John Waters advises us that you don't need fashion designers when you are young. Have faith in your own bad taste. Buy the cheapest thing in your local thrift shop. The clothes that are freshly out of style with even the hippest people a few years older than you. Get on the fashion nerves of your peers, not your parents. That is the key to fashion leadership. Ill-fitting is always stylish, but be more creative. Wear your clothes inside out, backward, upside down. Throw bleach in a load of coloured laundry. Follow the exact opposite of the dry cleaning instructions inside the clothes that cost the most in your thrift shop. Don't wear jewellery, stick band-aids on your wrists, or make a necklace out of them. Wear scotch tape on the side of your face like a bad facelift attempt. Mismatch your shoes. Best yet, do as Mink Stole used to do. Go to the thrift store the day after Halloween, when the children's trick-or-treat costumes are on sale. Buy one and wear it as your uniform of defiance. Waters also says, if you go home with somebody and they don't have books, don't fuck them. Try it, won't pick it up. Take them lights away. Try it, won't pick it up. Don't take your life away. Try it, won't pick it up. Don't try to take my knife away. And please don't you ask me if I love you. If you don't know what I'm doing, what you know is try it, won't pick it up. Take them lights away. Writer Brian Dillon observes that ghosting the entire aesthetics of taste for three centuries is the unacknowledged subject of class. If taste, as Roland Barthes writes, is a question of declaring that my body is not the same as yours, what is lost at that moment is all sense of the body as labouring or luxuriating, aristocratic or proletarian. Taste is posited as a mere fact of human nature, to which the naive question, who decides, is the traditional response. Who are any of us to dictate what is beautiful, what not? Here too is the crude formulation of the intimate relationship between taste and democracy, the whole politico-aesthetic problematic of the sensus communis. Bourdieu's book Distinction, a social critique of the judgment of taste, published in 1979, by far the most thorough reflection on taste in a century that mostly scorned the term, is not an answer to this innocent question, but a demonstration that the rules and hierarchies we inhabit or rail against are all systemic, not down to some lofty pronouncements by selected aesthetic gatekeepers. Whereas the ideology of charisma regards taste in legitimate culture as a gift of nature, scientific observation shows the cultural needs the result of upbringing and education. Is there a cultural realm where this insight is not now accepted as a given? Not only is it pretty much impossible to use the word taste without bringing to mind Bourdieu's study, a volume, by the way, that deploys throughout a distinction, at least verbally, between popular and legitimate culture that now seems unthinkable. But the assumption that all critical judgments, private, institutional, academic, journalistic, come freighted with political interest, is the starting point for every consideration of art and culture today, up to and including the pronouncements of publicists and politicians. The pronouncement, as if we need to remind ourselves, is the guarantee of not having to do anything about the politics. But to say that taste is always politics disguised is not to say that it is always and only politics disguised. Despite the pressing knowledge that my taste is ideologically implicated, always this language of guilt, and my unperverted sentiments, as Hume would put it, must have gone somewhere. Where, as they say, is the love?
So fine. Some paintings are sad and passionate, but Vermeer sends a chill up your spine. Yeah, Vermeer sends a chill up your spine. Vermeer was eerie, Vermeer was strange. He had a more modern color range, as if born in another age, like maybe 100 or so years ago. What's this, a ghost in the gallery? Great Scott, the Martians are here. These strange little paintings next to the others, no one was like Vermeer. Vermeer was eerie, Vermeer was weird. He had his own way of doing things with the paintings from another era, another era.
is my idol. Albert Finney and Tom Courtney, Wayne D. Craig and Carol White, Oliver Reed and Rita Tushenkirk. These are a few of my favourite films. Malcolm McDowell is my idol. Albert Finney and Tom Courtney, Wayne D. Craig and Carol White, Oliver Reed and Rita Tushenkirk. These are my favourite films, films I can watch time and time again. This is my ideal world. Malcolm McDowell is my idol. Albert Finney and Tom Courtney, Wayne D. Craig and Carol White, Oliver Reed and Rita Tushenkirk. These are my favourite films, films I can watch time and time again. This is my ideal world. These are my favourite films. This is my ideal world.
Lucy R. Lippard's blistering 1977 essay, The Pink Glass Swan, Upward and Downward Mobility in the Art World, attacks the class myopia of the art community. In particular, the first wave of conceptual artists with whom she herself associated in the late 1960s. In one passage, she describes how artists are persistently working up to be accepted, not only by other artists, but also by the hierarchy that exhibits, writes about, and buys her or his work. At the same time, she/he is often ideologically working down in an attempt to identify with the workers outside of the art context. This conflict is augmented by the fact that most artists are originally from the middle class, and their approach to the bourgeoisie includes a touch of adolescent rebellion against authority. Those few who have actually emerged from the working class sometimes use this, their very lack of background privilege, as privilege in itself, while playing the same schizophrenic foreground role as their solidly middle class colleagues.
In my plan, you're a subject. You keep on reaching for my mind. You keep on searching for my mind. In my
Owen Hatherley, in his book Militant Modernism, asks, if ordinary people are so hostile to new forms, new noises and new shapes, then how did the last 40 years of all kinds of jarring avant-garde street music manage to happen? Were the Teds, the Mods, glam rockers, punks, junglists, even the kids in provincial towns getting wrecked on Saturday nights to the ludicrously simple and artificial hard house of happy hardcore, all somehow class traitors?
This is the best bit. I think we'll take a break.
Have a break. Have a Kit Kat.
What do you think? You can't sing, you can't play, you look awful. You'll go a long way.
Mark Grief explains in a statement for the book What Was the Hipster? That the hipster, both in black and white incarnations, in his essence had been about superior knowledge. What Anatole Broillard, in his 1948 article, A Portrait of the Hipster, called a priorism. Broillard insisted that black hipsterism was developed from a sense that black people in America were subject to decisions made about their lives by conspiracies of power which held a monopoly on information and knowledge that they could never possibly know. The hip reaction was to insist, purely symbolically, on forms of knowledge which you, the black knower, possessed before anyone else, and in fact before the creation of positive knowledge, a priori. Broillard focused on the password language of hip slang. So this symbolic knowledge functioned either as self-assertion or as compensation. In an essay published in Paper Monument, called Black Bleeds Red, Jason Murison states, the staggering number of creative class 20-year-olds on the L subway train in New York with full-sleeve tattoos should have indicated to us that we'd finally, inevitably, overextended ourselves.
A flat man. One eye shut, a man is flat. Through a shut eye, a flat man.
In recent years, a curious flattening of taste and issues of distinction has occurred. It's one that has, in part, been wrought by changes in technology. New media has made access to imagery and sound so much easier now than it was even just 15 years ago. There was a time when the descriptions and photographs in style magazines or music papers were the only source of information about the latest music or fashion. There might be a photo of some impossibly cool kids at a gig in London, Berlin, Vancouver or New York, but if it was just of their head and shoulders, you could see how they cut their hair, but had to imagine what sort of trousers they might wear. Has a lack of access itself been an innovating catalyst in culture, producing something original by dint of not having a copybook to work from, not knowing the whole picture? Some have argued that the issue of taste has exploded and splintered into myriad shards of micro-differentiated social groups. Yet writing about the iPod and its effects on taste, Nikhil Saval says that modes of listening seem to be moving toward a total pluralism of taste. This has become the most celebrated feature of the iPod era. "I have seen the future," Alex Ross, music critic of The New Yorker, wrote in 2004, and it is called the shuffle. The setting on the iPod that skips randomly from one track to another. Here the iPod, or the digitizations of music it represents, promises emancipation from questions of taste. Differences in what people listen to, in a shuffled world, may have less and less to do with social class and purchasing power. Or better yet, taste won't correlate to class distinction, the absence of taste will. As certain foodies score points by having eaten everything, blowfish, yak milk tea, haggis, hot dogs, so the person who knows and likes all music achieves a curious sophistication through indiscriminateness. The would-be escape from distinction more often becomes the highest and most annoying form of distinction there is. Meanwhile, 1,000 years of European art music is filed under classical. List the design vernaculars that art galleries share with, say, clothes boutiques or penthouse property developments. Minimal, tastefully understated monochromaticism, so as to let the product within be appreciated without distraction. Fittings made from brushed steel, floors from poured concrete or bleached wood. The windows from frosted glass, materials of classic modernist architecture. They can be combined in ways that suggest futuristic corporate efficiency or post-industrial melancholia. An old winch or section of timbering preserved as a nod to past use. London, New York, Berlin, Paris, Milan, Beijing. The look is an internationally homogeneous design vernacular with minor local variations.
In every dream home, a heartache, and every step I take takes me further from heaven. Is there a heaven? I'd like to think so. Standards of living, they're rising daily. But home, oh sweet home, it's only a saying. From bell push to faucet, in smart town apartment, the cottage is pretty, the main house a palace, penthouse perfection, but what goes on what to do there, better pray there. Open plan living, bungalow ranch style, all of its comforts seems so essential. I bought you mail order, my plain wrapper baby. Your skin is like vinyl, the perfect companion. You float in my new pool, deluxe and delightful, inflatable doll. My role is to serve you, disposable darling. Can't throw you away now, immortal and life-size. My breath is inside you, I'll dress you up daily and keep you till death size. Inflatable doll, lover ungrateful, I blew up your body, but you blew my mind.
Michael Bracewell, in his book The 90s, observes that the point about the gentrification of the avant-garde, however snooty one might want to be about the debasement of radicalization by commerce and fashionability, was that it was irresistible, aesthetically gorgeous. It flattered one's better conception of oneself as a culturally aware, urban and urbane kind of person. Taste is encoded into language. Where would middle-class aspirational shopping be if the lights went out on the words artisanal, organic, traditional, handmade, individually brewed, and local? Where would contemporary art be if the trip switch went on the specialized pieties of seriousness, interested in notions of referentiality, critique, discourse, boundaries, performativity, interrogate, audience preconceptions, artist names exchanged as collateral by those jockeying for position in the marketplace of curating, criticism or sales. In conversation, it is an occultly scientific jargon. Ideas get refined into elegant commodities with a high surface finish. New, bright, conclusive.
I like to do a song of great social and political import. It goes like this. Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime, no help from my friends. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Dialing for dollars is trying to find me. I wait for delivery each day until 3. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? I'm counting on you, Lord. Please don't let me down. Prove that you love me and buy the next round. Oh Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? Everybody, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime, no help from my friends. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? That's it.
We'd see faces in movies, on TV, in magazines, and in books. He thought that some of these faces might be right for him, and that through the years, by keeping an ideal facial structure fixed in his mind, or somewhere in the back of his mind, that he might, by force of will, cause his face to approach those of his ideal. The change would be very subtle. It might take 10 years or so. Gradually his face would change its shape. A more hooked nose. Wider, thinner lips. Beady eyes. A larger forehead. This was an ability he shared with most other people. They had also molded their faces according to some ideal. Maybe they imagined a new face would better suit their personality. Or maybe they imagined that their personality would be forced to change to fit the new appearance. Might have made mistakes. They may have arrived at an appearance that bears no relationship to them. They may have picked an ideal appearance based on some childish whim or momentary impulse. Some may have gotten halfway there and then changed their mind. If he too might have made a similar mistake.
Questions of taste and cultural authority are closely bound up with the issue of authenticity. Sharon Zukin, in her book Naked City, writes,
Claiming authenticity becomes prevalent at a time when identities are unstable and people are judged by their performance rather than by their history or innate character. Under these conditions, authenticity differentiates a person, a product, or a group from its competitors. It confers an aura of moral superiority,
a strategic advantage that each can use to its own benefit. In reality, few groups can be authentic in the contradictory ways that we use the term.
On the one hand, being primal, historically first, or true to a traditional vision. And on the other hand, being unique, historically new, innovative,
and creative.
In modern times, though, it may not be necessary for a group to be authentic. It may be enough to claim to see authenticity in order to control its advantages. If authenticity has a schizoid quality, it can also be deliberately made up of bits and pieces of cultural references.
Artfully painted graffiti on a shop window, sawdust on the floor of a music bar, an address in a gritty but not too thoroughly crime-ridden part of town.
These fictional qualities of authenticity are not real, but they have a real effect on our imagination of the city, and a real effect as well on the new cafes, stores, and gentrified places where we like to live and shop. Because the emergence of the term reflects the importance of our roles as cultural consumers who consume the city's art, food, and images, and also its real estate, authenticity becomes a tool, along with economic and political power, to control not just the look, but the use of real urban places, neighbourhoods, parks, community gardens, shopping streets. Authenticity, then, is a cultural form of power over space that puts pressure on the city's old working class and lower middle class, who can no longer afford to live or work there.
We are the Village Green Preservation Society. God save the old duck, Bonneville and variety. We are the Desperate Dan Appreciation Society. God save strawberry jam and all the different varieties. Preserving the old ways from being abused. Protecting the new ways for me and for you. What more can we do? We are the Draft Beer Preservation Society. God save Mrs. Moss and good old Mother Riley. We are the Custom Pie Appreciation Consortium. God save the George Cross and all those who are loving them. We are the Sherlock Holmes English-speaking vernacular. God save Fu Manchu, Moriarty and Dracula. We are the office block, persecution affinity. God save little shots, China cups and virginity. We are the skyscraper, condemnation affiliates. God save Tudor houses, anti-tables and millions. Serving the old ways from being abused. Protecting the new ways for me and for you. What more can we do? We are the Village Green Preservation Society. God save Donald Duck, Bonneville and variety. We are the Desperate Dan Appreciation Society. God save strawberry jam from all the different varieties.
Time into the past, taking retro to its logical conclusion.
Today, nostalgia exerts a tyrannical influence over our cultural and consumer landscape. It conditions our taste in music, clothes, food, design, and where we take our holidays, and it muddles our sense of what authenticity might mean. In art in recent years, we've witnessed many artists turn their gaze on the halcyon days of vanguard modernism, or on the political activism of previous generations. They lament the passing of failed utopian projects with paintings and sculptures that hark back to the abstract forms of Russian constructivism, or the streamlined forms of the Bauhaus, or photographs that depict modernist interiors or long-forgotten monuments. We've seen how images of students manning the barricades in May 68, or striking miners, or influential, existentially troubled underground bands become visual shorthand for lost radicalism, idealism, and a clearly defined ideological position. A memory of resistance. Designers ransack the archives for images and products they can use that evoke the comforts of yesteryear. Digital radios that look like 1940s wireless sets. Tin ceramic pots that look like pans from ration-era Britain, to be sold in expensive homeware shops modelled on some ideal of the old family corner shop. High-specification Japanese cars that look like cute early 60s sports cars. In the UK, TV channels recycle much-loved shows from the past, broadcasts bookended by dull celebrities waxing tediously about their experiences watching The Generation Game or Dad's Army. High street fashion loops the loop of retro styling with increasing speed, 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and then a soft shoe shuffle back to the start of the cycle again. In the world of music, aging rock bands and pop stars who swore they'd never set foot on a stage again can now be found making a tidy living on the retro tour circuit, whilst musicians a quarter of the age of the undead rockers make music that sounds like it was recorded 30 or 40 years ago and model their look on subcultural styles almost as old as they are, getting away with it because Western culture still cleaves to the idea that youth is always the locus of radicalism.
Oh, All you timeless children with your predictions and flashbacks, trying to get ahead. What makes you think I can see you? What makes you think I believe you? Dreams inside my bed. Have you heard the family music that I'm wailing? Shot from the past. All the dreams are flying, all the thoughts are dying. Heard from the past. All you false pretenders and your freaky contenders, trying to be the first. In my own opinion, you I'm not defending. You are the worst. You make the world like a circus and you're trying to curse us. Cruel, you know no bounds. But we won't let you beat us, no, we won't let you cheat us. It's only one time around.
Something look awkward, or to be in bad taste, or uncool, or of little formal interest, or dealing with unfashionable ideas, if it is too far out of step with the times, or too much of its own time, too close to the immediate present. What can we do in order to see things better, more clearly,